Nancy Kincaid grew up in Tallahassee, Florida. She earned a BA from Athens State College in 1987, an MFA in fiction from the University of Alabama in 1991. She's the author of two novels, Crossing Blood in 1992, about which Henry Louis Gates said, "Finally, a Southern novel that a black person can love, can believe. Crossing Blood signals the arrival of a major talent among American novelists." And Balls in 1998, a life story set in the college football culture of the South, a topic about which Ms. Kincaid has had ample opportunity for research, as both her ex and her present husband are college football coaches. Her short story collection, Pretending the Bed is a Raft, earned critical acclaim. Kirkus Review, notoriously tight-fisted in handing out laurels, called the story dazzling, exquisite, and Kincaid a vigorous talent. Her work has appeared in many distinguished journals, including the Oxford American, Missouri Review, and Ontario Review. Among her honors, she received a fellowship from the National Endowment for the Arts and the coveted Bunting Fellowship from Radcliffe College. This semester, she's teaching in our creative writing program, for which we are immensely grateful. I was fascinated to learn that while Kincaid was enjoying the artistic and intellectual luxury of her Bunting Fellowship, she became friends with Carol Gilligan, the renowned Harvard psychologist who has done groundbreaking work on the moral development of women, published in a book I'm sure many of you know, In a Different Voice. That affinity strikes me as a significant detail in Kincaid's biography, as is, of course, her propensity to team up with coaches. It is easy to say that Balls is a novel about football, but also it is a story about football as a microcosm for our culture's dominant values. It's the story of women finding their own honest voices in such a culture. And it is the story of one woman's hard-won self-definition in a male world. Please welcome Nancy Kincaid.
Thank you. Can you hear me all right? How's that? Is that better? Well, thank you all for coming tonight. This is sort of a thrill for me because I've given, I think, two readings in Tucson, and usually only my blood relatives come. So this is a real pleasure to read to people that don't know me. And I want to say a special thanks to my students who are here tonight, especially after class today, which was a long, grueling class. It makes for a long day. I'm really smart enough to know that a fiction writer should always read something funny. Work in progress. And sometimes it's really a mistake to do, because in the past I've read from a work in progress only then to go home and throw it away. It's going to all depend on how you guys are breathing while I'm reading. And this is part of what I'm thinking of as a trilogy of novellas, which I will call Three Wives, which sounds like Dick should have written it, but nonetheless. just teasing, though. But it's Three Wives. The first story, the first novella, is titled, for a little light reading, Try the Sperm Catalog. And it's a woman who's getting a divorce and has two children. Her husband has left her for a younger, more interesting woman. Meanwhile, her best friend, who's never been married, decides that she wants a child. So she sends off, these women, all my women live in Alabama, I don't know, they can't help it. So they send off to California for a sperm catalog because they don't want to mix with relatives, right? And they get this sperm catalog, and it's about reading about men as in the way that they're summarized. One woman in particular, she almost has every man in the book memorized. And how after a while, the men who only have numbers, they don't have names, the men in the sperm catalog become more real to them than the men in their lives. And this story, which even though I told my students to title everything no matter what, the story I'm going to read from tonight is untitled. And I won't give you much feedback about it, except that it takes place in Butler County, Alabama, fictional county, I hope, that has no town in it. It's one of those kind of counties where you go across the line to the neighboring county's mall. You know that kind of county? Where people build houses when they first get married, and the rest of their lives they spend finishing them, adding on, you know. That's just a kind of happy rural southern setting, I guess you would say. I also want to say a little thanks to my mother, because it's from my mother in my fiction. And I'm not always conscious of it at first. And I never have had her read anything before I went ahead with it. And she always pretends she does not recognize herself at all. And I think she really doesn't. Although there's 6 kids in the family, and all the rest of them really recognize her. But in this story, I have borrowed one of her boyfriends, who was a guy named Happy Cat. Happy Cat she met at the Elks Club, where she was a great card player. And he was a mailman. And in the summer, when she had off from school, she would get in his mail truck, which is absolutely against the law, which was quite a thrill, and go on his mail route with him. So I borrowed Happy Cat, and I don't know how long I'm going to read. I hope I'll read far enough to introduce you to Happy Cat. But don't mistake Bina, the character here, for my mother. She's got a lot of kids, but that's the only similarity. Logistical thing here. Lord, Eddie had gotten tired of watching his mother, Bina, sit in the yard in a folding chair with all the mismatched laces unraveling, just sit there with a cup of coffee in her hand and contemplate the sorry shape of her life, her head bowed low in something that looked like defeat or prayer, since the two can look the same from a distance. But Eddie had a pretty good idea that no prayer was going on out there. He figured it was more like an endless question-answer session with a God she had once believed in and tried to make all of them believe in a long, long time ago, before everything got so messed up and she got so tired. It was just in the last year, when things should be back to normal, that Bina had begun to sit alone in the yard drinking her morning coffee and waiting for the sun to come up before going off to work over at the school administration building, filling out government forms. She waited for the sunrise the way a person waits for a big disappointment and then is not surprised when it comes, because it proves the ongoingness of disappointment, like one thing in this world you can count on. The rest of them had more or less bounced back, you know, the flat way a ball with not much air in it bounces. But still, they had stopped looking behind them and started looking ahead into that magic place everybody was always talking about. The future, where everything was not only possible, but likely. Hadn't his mother spent the last decade trying to make sure they all believed in that, the future? The future was her God, wasn't it? And now here she was, giving up. When she got home from work in the evening, she microwaved a cup of leftover morning coffee and sat right there again in that same damn chair, this time turned to face the sunset. Sometimes she sat there until after dark, until Eddie, her youngest son, called out to her. What are you doing out there, Mama? Are we going to have any supper or what? Bina would rise like a zombie and come inside and bang around in the kitchen until she had produced plates of eggs and toast, or spaghetti, or a couple of chicken pot pies. Gone were the days when Bina used to clip recipes out of the Sunday paper and try out weird but delicious casseroles on the family as if they were a bunch of guinea pigs. She had the pig part right, Eddie thought. He could not remember a time when he wasn't hungry. With 5 kids in the family and him the youngest, Eddie had learned to grab and gobble. Slow down, Eddie, his mother used to say. We got plenty, son. But he had never been sure of that. Now Bina cooked exactly the same way a person fell asleep. She just got in position and let herself go. And before she knew what was happening, she had supper on the table. It was both totally predictable and also a little like magic. I sat down. Eddie asked the sing-song grace he had memorized as a child the only real poem he knew by heart, and they ate whatever food Bina had caused to appear before them. Eddie had plans to go off to college in the fall. He'd surprised everybody and gotten a track scholarship. Up until then, Bina had thought Eddie was more or less lazy. She knew he liked to run, but she didn't think of running as something good to do with your life. In fact, it bothered her seeing Eddie run so much, like he was trying to get away from something, but couldn't. Bina knew he counted the days until he could leave home and move into a tiny 8x8 dorm room with some strange boy he didn't know. Perhaps a long-distance runner, one of those real skinny boys from some exotic land, and start, at last, to be really, truly happy for a change. Bina wondered when exactly happiness had started to be something that happened far away from home, something you had to leave home to go get. And how had all Bina's children managed to figure that out when Bina hadn't? "Too much thinking is not good for a person, Mama," Eddie said. "I'm not exactly thinking out there, son," Bina told him. "I'm meditating. They say you should sit quiet and meditate to start your day out and to finish it up. Who says that? All the people on the talk shows, all the health books, they say it's a good coping strategy. So how's it going then, Mama, all your coping?" "My mind just wanders over the same stuff when I meditate as it does when I think. It feels like I got a broken record going around in my head." "I think you need to forget about meditating and take up a hobby, Mama. It's good to keep busy." "I wish I had a dime for every hobby I'd taken up over the years. Remember when I used to make those Christmas decorations out of eggshells? Heck yeah, she used to make me and Joe suck the egg out first." "You were supposed to blow," Bina said, "not suck." "Yeah, well, now you tell me." "They sure were pretty, weren't they? All those sequins and the little deer I used to glue inside. You remember that? I thought you were going to kill me and Joe when we fell into the Christmas tree and crushed those ornaments. I never seen you go so crazy. First you were screaming, then you were crying. Y'all shouldn't have been roughhousing in the living room. It might be funny now, but at the time it almost broke my heart to see you knock that tree over like that. I'd worked so hard on that tree, staying up late at night after all you kids were asleep, trying to make everything just right, you know, the perfect Christmas. It was the first Christmas after your daddy died. I guess I was a little crazy then." Eddie didn't like to talk about his daddy dying. He hardly ever even thought about it anymore. And if it weren't for the pictures his mother saved in the photo album, he would have already forgotten what his daddy looked like. It seemed like a long time ago that his daddy had tried to ruin all their lives. Maybe his sisters still liked to discuss the matter, but he didn't. "I still say you need a hobby, Mama," Eddie said. "Lord knows I need more than a hobby, son." "Like what?" "I don't know exactly. Some good reasons or something." "Well, I can't help you there," Eddie said. "I'm fresh out." He stood up and rinsed his dishes and put them in the dishwasher and kissed Bina on the cheek. "I'm out of here for a while," he said, "going to Anna Kay's." Anna Kay was Eddie's girlfriend. She was the kind of girl who was so cheerful that it was a wonder nobody had killed her yet. But if anybody ever did kill her, it wouldn't be Eddie, that was for sure. He loved Anna Kay's cheerful ways. He wished everybody would take a lesson from Anna Kay's positive attitude, because then, to his way of thinking, this would be a better world. He had made a personal decision never to voluntarily become involved with a woman who was not cheerful. His mother and sisters had almost run him crazy with some heartache and bouts of moral outrage. He liked simple women better. He liked Anna Kay, who, as far as he could tell, woke up happy and went to bed happy and experienced nothing but happiness in between. He was real lucky to find a girl like that. When Bina's husband, Bobby, had been killed 10 years ago, it had put Bina's life on a path that she had not chosen and didn't know how to get off of. Looking back, it seemed Bina's life had more or less belonged to her right up to the minute Bobby died and took it away. With Bobby in the grave, Bina's life had quickly become about doing what Bobby wasn't there to do, like keep the lawn mowed, keep the car running, pay off the mortgage, and raise his kids right so that they would all turn out decent, reasonably athletic, and honest, which she had done, not a criminal among them. They were serious children. Now, maybe that was true. When Bina looked back, she thought probably they hadn't laughed enough or ever found the pleasure of pure out-and-out silliness. But on the other hand, not a one of them was mean. It was years ago now, but sometimes it still seemed like yesterday. The news, which is how they talked about it still. The night we got the news, when he told Mama the news, when the news hit school, etc. For Bina and all her kids, the news would always be something that happened 10 years ago, not something they tuned into nightly on TV or read about in the newspaper. That stuff was just a bunch of current events, most of which barely had a thing to do with any of them. But the news was and always would be personal. Bina, honey, there's been an accident. It's Bobby, killed in a rollover. And Bina, now not alone. There was a woman. The news had come at once like that, packaged in sentence fragments, and even after all these years, Bina had never really sorted it all out and made any sense of it. She had been at home with the kids that night, the five of them. Eddie, the baby, was just 8, and Sissy, the oldest, was a senior in high school. The TV was on, and every radio and stereo in the house was blaring out some competing noise. Bina was grading papers at the kitchen table. She had the kind of mind that could cut right through the distractions of life and stay focused on her task. She was a 6th grade teacher then, a good one. That was before she found out they would pay her better money to fill out government forms than they would to teach the children anything about the government. That was back when Bina still believed that certain things were worth doing. And then there came the knock at the door that changed everything, and the police with the car with its flashing light parked in the yard, making Elvis howl like all get out, as if he knew exactly what had happened by instinct. And all 5 of her golden children, wide-eyed and frozen, at the news that Bobby Eckerd, their daddy, was dead. 2 afternoons earlier, Bobby had told Bina he was going to a meeting in Montgomery. His company was trying to get a bid in on paper supplies for Maxwell, the Air Force base. He said it would take him a day or two, and kissed Bina goodbye. And she had let him go off being believed. The police said his car went off the embankment up on that twisty part of Highway 82. They said it just looked like he forgot to take the curb, like maybe he thought for a minute his car was an airplane, and that it would just lift off and sail him through the air, like he was a pilot, like he could take wing and fly. There were no skid marks, the policeman said, no signs of braking. Car rolled over 6 or 8 times. Bobby was killed instantly. They found a woman in a ravine with her skull mostly crushed. She was still breathing. They took her to Jackson Hospital and called all of her next of kin. I'm sorry, Miss Eckerd, the policeman kept saying to Bina. I'm real sorry, ma'am. The day after the accident, the newspaper ran the pictures of Bobby and the woman together, side by side, like a pair. Accident takes local man's life, the paper said. Woman in critical condition. Bina's daughter, Ellie, had brought the newspaper into Bina's bedroom to show it to her. Mama, she said, you want to see what the woman looked like? Bina sat up in bed and studied the picture of the woman. Her name was Lorraine Mayfield. She was only 28. Bina had never laid eyes on her before. Her hair was dark and curly, and Bina remembered thinking she probably dyed it to get it so dark looking. Bina searched her face and decided that she might be foreign or something, Mexican maybe, or Puerto Rican. A stranger just passing through on her way someplace else. It was clear she was not someone who belonged in Bina's or Bobby's life. She's not as pretty as you, Mama, Ellie said. Pretty is as pretty does, Bina said. I bet she's not as nice as you either. There's more important things than being pretty or nice, Ellie. You remember that, okay? Yes, ma'am, Ellie said. Like what? I don't know for sure right this minute, being said. You're going to have to ask me later, okay? Like being alive, Ellie said. It's more important to be alive, right? Bobby's funeral was well attended because nearly everybody loved Bobby Eckert. His children were all well scrubbed and good looking and behaved in a way that would make any father, even a dead one, proud. His wife, Vina, was composed and gracious. Anybody that pitied her was wasting time. At least that's what she liked to tell herself. Vina had entered the church with her two sons and three daughters flanking her like clear-skinned, blue-eyed soldiers, and she had felt real strong in the midst of them. What Bobby Eckert had needed with Lorraine Mayfield, Vina might never know, but she was not going to let her children become ashamed of their father. She was going to insist that they look beyond the obvious. That's what she had always tried to do herself. It rained when Bobby was laid in the ground. Black umbrellas surrounded the grave like so many gnats clustered on a wound. It was muddy and messy, and the coffin slipped and sank while the men tried to steer it into place. Amen, people kept saying. Vina watched it all like she was a person in the audience at a really sad movie. That night, her son Joe said, "Daddy ruined everything, didn't he, Mama?" "No, son," Vina said, "he changed everything. But we're not going to let everything be ruined." It was 2 weeks after Bobby had been buried that Vina got the phone call from Lorraine Mayfield's mother. "Miss Eckert," she said, "please forgive me for intruding on your terrible grief." Vina had been too stunned to speak. "I'm calling to ask you something," Mrs. Mayfield said. "It's very hard for me, and I hope you will forgive me." "What is it?" Vina asked. "It's Lorraine," Mrs. Mayfield said. "She's not doing good. The doctors say it's only a matter of time until, you know, everything shuts down. She needs the last rites. Her brain, you know, is..." "I'm sorry," Vina said. "So what I'm wondering is, I was thinking if you might... I would like Lorraine to die in peace, you know? Do you think you might be able to forgive her?" "Well, I didn't raise Lorraine to be off with somebody's husband. I know in her heart she's so sorry. It's just that if you could forgive her, then maybe she could go, you know? Die. I think she's lingering until she gets the forgiveness." "What do you want me to do?" Vina asked. "Can you come to the hospital?" It sounded to Vina like the woman must be Catholic or something. All that talk about forgiveness and last rites. Vina was a Baptist. She knew nothing about all the rigmarole the Catholics put their dying loved ones through. She had no idea what they expected from her. "Forgiveness," Lorraine's mother had said. Vina drove to Montgomery without telling anyone where she was going. She could not have said why she was doing this exactly, except that she had been asked to. For the most part, when she could, Vina tried to do what people asked her to. Mrs. Mayfield, Lorraine's mother, didn't look any older than Vina. She looked like she could just as easily have been the woman in Bobby's car, a woman, maybe like her daughter, so compelling that Bobby would be unable to keep his eyes off her and on the road. "Thank you for coming," she whispered. "It's okay," Vina said. "I'll show you where she is." Miss Mayfield took Vina's hand and led her down the intensive care hallway into a cold, well-lit room with a roll-up bed in the middle of it. A bandaged, wired Lorraine Mayfield lay in the bed looking as small as a child. "She can hear you," Miss Mayfield said. "The doctors will tell you she can't, but she can." Miss Mayfield leaned over the bed and whispered, "Lorraine, honey, Bobby's wife is here to see you. It's okay. She's not mad." Then she kissed the bandaged head and stepped away from the bed. "I'll give you a few minutes alone," she said. "I'll wait." For an instant, Vina didn't want to be left alone with this small, dying woman. She stared at the swollen face of a person she did not know at all. Lorraine's eyes were sealed closed and her face was purple and distorted. It occurred to Vina that the dark curly hair in the newspaper picture had been shaved so that the doctors could try to stitch her head together in some hopeless gesture that only they understood. Vina pulled a tall hospital stool to the bedside and sat on it. She touched Lorraine's hand, but it was dry as paper. "This is really strange, isn't it?" Vina whispered. "Your mama called me," she said. For a minute, Vina just sat and stared at the tiny figure in the bed. She could be one of Vina's daughters. Sissy, maybe. Sissy was a child with a wild streak, too, wasn't she? She tried to imagine Bobby in a car with this woman, but she couldn't think of it. What they would say to each other, where they might be going, what Lorraine had been wearing or planning. It was all dark and impossible. "Okay," Vina took a deep breath. "So here goes. Your mother says you can hear me. I don't know how you knew Bobby, how long or how well. But look, Bobby was a real easy guy to love. You should have seen his funeral. Everybody came, practically the whole town. So you shouldn't feel too bad because you loved him too, okay?" Even as she spoke, Vina wondered if she meant a word she was saying. Words just came to her like she'd been rehearsing for this scene all her life. She would have laid hands on and healed Lorraine Mayfield if she could have. She would have commanded her to rise from her bed and go forth and sin no more. It was odd how connected she felt to this woman, the one whose hand she kept instinctively touching. Later, she would accuse herself of simply being curious to see what the woman looked like. The woman who had been died. The woman who, dead or alive, had altered Vina's life forever. Some of the teachers at school had told Vina that lots of times a dead loved one will appear in the night to have a last word with you, or maybe, in Bobby's case, try to explain things and beg for forgiveness. They said, "You'll think you're dreaming, but you won't be." One of the teacher's mothers had appeared in a white nightgown at the foot of her bed and touched her foot. And the other's son had waked her up just to say he loved her. He had shot himself in the face with his father's gun, but wanted her to know it was not her fault. Lord, Vina hoped this was true. She was ready to believe it because she needed a last word with Bobby, to know for sure that his sin had not backfired so bad that he had completely lost his salvation. Vina herself had witnessed his being saved. He had walked the aisle for Christ, and the preacher shook his hand and patted him on the back and everything. There was no doubt at the time that it was for real. Some people said they could see a change in him. Now, Vina went to bed at night in a state of waiting, praying that Bobby's spirit would come to her just once. She would say, "Bobby, is heaven real?" She would say, "Look what you've done." Some nights she fell asleep imagining Bobby and Lorraine both appearing together, sitting on the edge of her bed, holding hands, their wings fluttering like a couple of lovesick angels. It wasn't until Vina got the call from Mrs. Mayfield less than a month later, saying that Lorraine had died without ever opening her eyes, that a merciful God had taken her home at last, that Vina began to comprehend death of it. It was only then, when she knew that Lorraine was buried more than 60 miles from where Bobby was buried, that she finally stopped looking for Bobby to come up the drive at the end of the day, blowing his horn like a public service announcement or a warning to any children who had a talking to coming that he was home. Now, when Vina looked back at her marriage, she couldn't remember a single time when she hadn't been glad to see Bobby ever come home. He would sling his briefcase on the dining room table and walk across the room in his wilted white short-sleeved shirt, loosening his necktie along the way, give her a little automatic kiss on the cheek and say, "How's the queen doing?" That was what he had called Vina, the queen. Then he would head for the bedroom and change into shorts and a t-shirt. And if it was summer, he might mow the grass. Or if it was winter, he might rake the pine straw into mounds and cushion the flower beds with it, or throw the ball with Bobby and Tommy until one of them got frustrated and started to cry, or watch Sissy practice her baton twirling, figure eight after endless figure eight. or talk Leslie into letting the turtle she caught go, convincing her that life in a cardboard box was not worth living, no matter how loved one was. And if Leslie could not be convinced, then it was Bobby who dug the turtle's grave and put the dogwood blooms on it. Bobby might fill up all the bird feeders with sunflower seeds, or pour kerosene on the fire ant beds dotting the yard, or spray the deck with water repellent to prevent rot, or put sand on the oil spills lighting the carport floor. Bobby was always doing something, with Elvis trailing him every step he took. Bobby claimed he had gotten Elvis for the kids, but Elvis had never belonged to anybody but Bobby. It was Bobby who picked him out of the litter, and it was Bobby who named him. Vina had protested. "Elvis," she said, "no way. Naming a dog War Eagle or Roll Tide or something corny and cliche like that." But Bobby had insisted, saying, "Look how black his fur is. It's so black it's blue, like Elvis's shoe-polished hair." Bobby had always loved the story about Elvis putting black shoe polish on his hair for dramatic effect, and then getting rained on big time, and all that black just washing down his face and staining his clothes, and everybody laughing at him and thinking he was real weird. It was stories like that that made Bobby love Elvis Presley. He loved him as much as any girl ever did, maybe more. Sort of embarrassed Vina, too, having a husband that worshipped Elvis like that. She wished Bobby would get more current. Sometimes on Sunday nights, Bobby put Elvis' gospel music on the stereo and played it full blast, and when the kids came and gawked at him in horror, saying, "Daddy, stop it," he would smile and say, "The Catholics, now they may have the Pope with that crown on his head, but us Baptists, we got Elvis. We got the King." He would actually get tears in his eyes when Elvis sang Amazing Grace, like that was the one song in the world that made Bobby believe in the Holy Spirit for real. Vina had asked the preacher to play Elvis's Amazing Grace at Bobby's funeral, too, which he did, after which she could never stand to listen to it again. Bobby was ordinarily not the kind of man who let himself get bored, although on rare nights he might just sit in the den and watch the news like he was in a trance, waiting for Vina to get supper on the table. Bobby had been a casserole man, too. Chicken casserole was his favorite, the one with the spaghetti noodles, cheddar cheese, and almonds. Most men are meat and potatoes guys, but Bobby was different that way. He liked everything all mixed together from the beginning. After supper sometimes, Bobby would sit in the yard with Elvis under his chair and smoke a cigar. The cigar stinked away, he liked to say, but it did not keep the children away. When the children were little, they practiced their headstands and backbends in the grass where he sat, saying, "Watch this, Daddy." And Bobby watched them tirelessly, his cigar smoke settling like a gray cloud around his head. Sometimes he'd send the children to the kitchen saying, "Go tell the Queen to come out here. Tell her there's a handsome traveling salesman out here who's craving her company." Minutes later, the children would run back to him saying, "Daddy, Mama's coming as soon as she finishes cleaning up the kitchen." But sometimes it took longer than Vina expected, and Bobby would come inside before she could make her way outside. She regretted that now. Vina had relived their early life from a million different angles since Bobby died. She remembered him the same way you remember a magic trick. All the pleasure is in the bewilderment. It used to be, when Bobby had walked through the door at the end of the day, Elvis panting at his heels, Vina's life had made perfect sense. The meatloaf she was slapping into shape made sense. The laundry she would rotate from washer to dryer to dresser drawers all evening long made sense. The children arguing and telling on each other and all their lamentations and denial made sense. The carving made sense. Her menstrual cramps made sense. The toilet whose handle had to be jiggled just right to stop its whining made sense. Even her students, who, try as she might, she could not quite reach, who would leave her class still unable to read a standard paragraph and make any sense of it, even they made a sweeter, gentler sense. Bobby had had a way of putting sense into everything. That had been his gift to Vina. Marriage to Bobby had kept her very sane. first few months after Bobby was killed in the car accident, Happy Cat McHale, their mailman, had walked up the long drive and delivered the mail to Bina by hand so that she wouldn't have to make her way down to the mailbox just to get a fistful of overdue bills and rhyming sympathy cards. "Anything I can do to help out?" he asked her nearly every day from the beginning of her widowhood. Later, he got bolder and said, "You'll get over this, Bina. It might not seem like it now, but time is a great healer." "I haven't noticed time healing Sue Cox," Bina said. Sue Cox was Happy Cat's wife. It was as hateful a thing as Bina had ever said to anybody who was trying to be nice to her. Happy Cat had just stood and looked at her like she had slapped his face. Afterwards, he stopped hand-delivering her mail, just stuffed it in her mailbox the way he was required by law to do. Sometimes Bina wouldn't take in the mail for weeks at a time just because she couldn't stand to. She thought people should not be allowed to intrude on her life simply by licking a 30-cent stamp. Depending on the feel of the mail, she might just dump a whole handful of it straight in the trash and never so much as glance at the return addresses or the penmanship. All summer long, she did this. It was good when school started up again and she was forced back to work. For some reason, it seemed easier to make the transition from wife to widow while she was at school, where it was part of her job to be mature and appropriately distant. But at home, she remained a wife for the longest time, a wife with no husband, but with five children to concentrate on, which she did. She watched her children for signs of lingering sadness or loneliness or anger or any of the other sorts of things that were natural byproducts of grief, or normal rites of passage of adolescence. It seemed to her that every one of them took at least one turn to do something crazy that might get them killed or mess up their lives forever if Bina hadn't been around to happen. No mood of theirs went undetected or unaddressed, not until Bina was sure they had weathered the worst of things. By the time she was sure the children were going to survive and go on to thrive, a couple of years had passed, and they had started teasing her about needing to go out on a date. Bina didn't think about Happy Cat for a couple of years. She sometimes saw him go by in his U.S. mail van, but she didn't wave or honk her horn in recognition the way she once would have when Bobby was along. Bobby and Happy Cat had been friends in high school. Happy Cat had been a big-time athlete, and Bina supposed it was only when he was required to wear his postal uniform that he had finally given up wearing his letter jacket. He had played college ball until he hurt his knee. As far as she could tell, he had been one of those boys who was cursed with the great expectations of others, including Bobby. Bobby, who had never been an athlete, was an admirer of Happy Cat and had never stopped being disappointed for the way his career had failed to materialize. "Tough break," he used to say to Bina when they saw Happy Cat. He was one of the best. The one notable thing Happy Cat had done was marry Sue Cox Miller. She was a year younger than Bina and had been the girl that other girls assumed all the boys wanted to marry. She was rich, for one thing. That might have been enough by itself. But she was beautiful, too, and there was nobody anywhere who would ever say different. Even now, when middle age had her in its clutches, it was gentle with her. As a girl, she had always been free-spirited in a way that had set her apart from most of the other girls, who had more or less set their sights on going to heaven and hooking up with Jesus in the afterlife. Obviously, this had not been part of secret lane. It wasn't just the drinking and the partying that she did better than everybody else, but it was her bold, unladylike style that made her so universally appealing to almost everyone. Like getting arrested for suggestive dancing on the roof of Happy Cat's car the night of the junior prom and spending the night in jail for disturbing the peace and public drunkenness. Or like cutting her hair short when everybody else's hair was long and she was drunk and somebody dared her. Even with her head half skin and her dark hair in little butchered tufts, she was still beautiful. Everybody knew that Mr. Stein, the math teacher, used to take Sue Cox out to lunch during his planning hour on school days and simply write for a pass to get back in class afterwards.
There were rumors that they really didn't go to lunch at all, but to his apartment, which had mirrors on the ceiling. In her purse, she carried a whole book of passes that he had signed for her, just in case a need ever arose. She was good about giving anyone who needed one a signed pass. Nobody ever said she was a stingy person. In those days, Sue Cox's drinking had seemed rebellious and full of style, something she would look back on someday and be happy about, while most of the other girls would be full of regret over how careful they had been, how worried about their imaginary reputation and what people would think. Even in high school, Vina had understood the sorts of regrets that would come later about having played it too safe and been too sweet. She knew those regrets lie in wait for her, but even so, she had been unable to set herself free the way Sue Cox could. She both admired and hated Sue Cox's gift. It was the kind of hatred good girls feel for the wild girl to get away with what the good girls are secretly afraid to try. It is an early form of jealousy, when jealousy is the poison of choice for so many girls' bodies, like Vina. That Sue Cox would choose to marry Happy Cat didn't surprise anybody. That he married her was even less of a surprise. The surprises had come later, when Happy Cat ended up without the pro career everyone was counting on, and instead became a civil servant, just like any ordinary federal postal employee earning his government check. And Sue Cox had discovered for herself, and revealed to all, that she was not, after all, just a bold and beautiful party girl who was simply sowing the wild oats to which she felt entitled and with which she thrilled everyone around her. But she was, instead, a relentless and chronic drunk, referred to by those who loved her as an alcoholic who suffered an insufferable disease. Booze had kept Sue Cox from holding a job or having any babies or, after three DUIs, driving a car. There was debate about whether or not the accident was really Sue Cox's fault, but there was no debate about the fact that it left the other drivers so mangled that her left leg had had to be amputated in order to get her out of the smoldering car. The only reason that Sue Cox didn't go to jail was because the woman with the amputated leg had had a higher blood alcohol level than Sue Cox, and she had been the one who sped through a stop sign and smashed headfirst into the rear end of Sue Cox's car. Afterwards, there was not much glamour left in Sue Cox's drunken escapades. The thrill was gone. Besides, drinking was the old-fashioned way to lose your mind and forget what you needed to forget. Now they had slick new designer drugs to do that for you. Drugs with catchy little names that you could buy from behind the Texaco station, from boys in sunglasses who lived in the housing project and whose baggy pants were falling off their behinds. Or you could buy from that lawyer up at the courthouse. People said there were two out at the hospital. Part of Sue Cox's drunk driving sentence was public service. She had to speak to the kids at the high school about the evils of alcohol. She had titled her talk, "It's Not Cool to Be a Fool." They put an article in the newspaper with a picture of Sue Cox talking to students. It looked like she was a preacher behind the pulpit, but everybody knew better. People began to find Sue Cox borderline pitiful instead of interesting. Now her life was a series of trips to rehab where she would dry out and explore the depths of her heart and history in search of some reason why or some evidence of an indestructible soul from which she could draw strength in the future, after which she would be sent home to slowly forget all that she had unearthed. In a matter of months, as a matter of course, she would begin to self-medicate again, just one beer at a ball game, just one sip of champagne at a wedding, just one shot of vodka to get her going in the morning. It was generally agreed that life had been cruel to Happy Cat and Sue Cox, first by blessing them so singularly, making them the envy of all, and then by allowing those same blessings to sour on them and become curses. Now they were reduced to living lessons for the young people in the county. Their lives provided perfect examples of why it is better to study than to be popular.
As adults, they cause most of their average friends to feel very lucky in comparison. But nobody ever really thought badly of either Happy Cat or Sue Cox. It was like they were living examples that life might actually be fair after all. So when the doorbell rang late one afternoon, too late for a mail delivery, Bina was not expecting to see Happy Cat McHale standing there, smiling. "Hey,"